do normally, but no. Actually, when you're hearing your own voice, it's coming back through your jawbone.
Well, I got to clean
it. We're recording and turn the intro. G'day and welcome to the Farmers Podcast. And my offside is Noel Bubner.
Good evening, listeners. How are we today? How are you, Andrew?
Yeah, not bad.
It's good. It Friday is. Friday evening podcast this week.
Yeah, who would have thought?
Who would have thought? I guess there's some busy people around.
Beautiful Clear Valley today.
And it's warm.
Well, it's not freezing like I thought it might be, so... yeah, it's quite pleasant. So today we'll be talking to Alan Mayfield. G'day, Alan.
Yeah, g'day, Andrew. G'day, Noel.
Evening, Alan. Thanks very much for coming along.
It's a pleasure. Welcome to my little office here.
I've torn you away from the footy on TV tonight. No. You're willing to come and have a chat with us.
No, I'm more than happy to do that.
Very good.
Yeah, so we'll might as well get started then, Alan. So you were an agronomist. You're retired now. And I know you do a lot of other things as well, but...
You were the agronomist.
Yeah, the go-to agronomist for South Australia at some point in time. And if you talk to any other agronomists in the field, they still hold Alan in high regard.
Have a chat to Andy Barr. He's got a few stories, a bit of gossip apparently on some time that he spent with Alan. may or may not be a lie.
So where were you born, Alan? You always been from Clare or...?
No, born at... Kimber, I reckon I'm pretty fortunate. I on a farm just south of Kimber on the way to Concutta, on a family farm. So I grew up in a rural environment, grew up on a farm. I don't know, my earliest memories of working on the farm was when my dad was out feeding sheep and he must have been about three or four, and I was standing on the seat of the ute trying to steer the ewes that went across the paddock while he was on the back tipping grain out. So and you learnt to drive by the time you were 10 and so on, milk cows and
what
so,
sort
so
of ute, what sort of ute were we driving around
You're
in?
Asking me a bit now. Yeah. I know when we were young teenagers, he bought an old Austin ute from the railways, and we all learnt, three boys learnt to drive on that. And,
You'd have learnt how to crank an engine in that, wouldn't you?
No, I didn't go back quite that far, but it was just full-on farm. You learnt the work ethic, like we sewed bags and you knew and jobs had to be done and worked long hours on the tractor with, I don't want to...
Pigs and chooks and...
Yeah, my brother had pigs and mother a few chooks, but yeah, just... big jobs, picking stumps. Like it was Mallee country, so a lot of picking stumps and by hand, and we'd spend Saturday mornings out picking stumps. We would have picked thousands of tons of stumps, you know. And okay. And then the next phase when we cleared some more land, well, it was just big machines and chains and ploughs, and it's all gone in a few days.
So which direction from Kimber?
It was ahead from Kimber towards Kynecutter or Ceduna on that main highway. So our farm was about 7 km's out on the eastern side of the road. There's a railway line, a bit of scrub, and then the farm, and it runs for about 8 km's along there. So it's sandy country.
Yep. Still in the family?
Yes, it is. My nephew Shannon's it, and going great guns. So it was out of the family for a while. We had a family tragedy when my younger brother, who was home on the farm, was killed in a plane accident, and then his wife and three kids went off up to Ceduna and made a sort of new life, if you like. But eventually Shannon was drawn back to the farm, and we had a terrific neighbours, Ray and Trevor Cliff, who took him under their wing, and they took on the lease of the farm, and then they helped Shannon get started. And he was smart enough to get old second-hand gear and make it work and not go too overcapitalised early on. You also realised that you needed sheep in that system, that you shouldn't just all cropping on some of that lighter country, and particularly with dry years. And he just works hard, gets a lot of support, so he's done well. So he's banded there and very, very much at home on the farm. So it was a farm my grandfather went to, and he was sort of forced to in a way. He had a much better farm at Kimber, and then he hit the bloody... late 20s with low wheat prices and the depression, and the bank just pulled the rug on him. And as a result of that, I guess my father, who grew up, and mother grew up in the depression, the war years, they're pretty frugal, as all, you know, that generation had to be. And so I guess I've inherited a little bit of that, and it's gone right through my career. It's just been careful.
Yes.
Whether it's be decisions with farmers or whatever it is.
Yeah. So I wonder if Shannon's being frugal. Is he engaged an agronomist, or is he still getting advice from you?
He certainly has, yeah. No, Shannon, he'll if he needs to know something, he'll get in person to help him out.
And is that you more often than not?
No. When I started agronomy, I left the department in the 1990, pretty well made a decision that I would work within, I could get back home at night. Yeah. I know I did go down to York Peninsula a bit, and I mean, the terrific hospitality there, they would have you stay the night, so it was fine, but and then you were there ready to go the next morning. But so I didn't never travel much to EP or Mallee or those sort of areas. I did occasionally, but not on a routine basis.
Yeah, I'm heading over there and 6 weeks or so. That's why I was just interested where your property is. I'll keep an eye out because I am going through Kimber.
Well, you see a lot of water there because they had this massive rain. I mean, the family farm name was called Laguna because it was actually a lagoon basin. And back in when my mum and dad were first married, it's late 40s, mid 40s, they had a big rain, big summer rain, and they had a big water over probably 15 hectares and about 3 or 4 metres deep.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
they had a regatta there.
Is that all full again?
It's got a lot in it. That was back earlier this year. Yeah. They had a massive rain there, as you know. And the only other time in my time was in the early 60s. We had about 2 metres of water for about a year across there. So she was going all through the scrub and a bit, yeah. So it's basically just a bit of a basin down from the houses where the dams are.
So what were they? What sort of vessels did they bring along to the regatta?
I have no idea. I've only seen an old photo. Your little bloody yachts or some damn thing. But yeah. I can tell you the modern way is recently my sister was over there and they had bloody speed boats and skiing going on.
Yeah, wow.
Where normally it could be dusty, you know. So that's sort of the nature of the country.
So schooling, is that at Kimber?
Yeah, certainly. The old school bus, pedalling to the bike stop and then school, light a fire and then wait for the school bus. And then until the end of year 10. And then I went to school in Adelaide for 2 years at Westminster when that was very new.
Culture shock.
Yeah. Like, I sort of thrived on it in a sense, I guess. I mean, the classes in year 10 at Kimber, there was only six, I think, in our class, and we had two streams of 30, and the upper stream in the middle, and then the bloody lads and farms generally in the rabble class. Yeah,
boarders.
I was a boarder, I was a boarder. And again, in boarder, you just had to get on with people and get on with it, and I was sort of able to do that. I was.
What year are we looking?
Years 11.
1960?
Oh, sorry, years. So that's his 1960. 1965 and 6. So the discipline was extraordinary. People just did things, and the high achievers were there and just recognised, you know. Probably didn't matter whether it was academic or sport or even did well at bloody darts, you know, on the weekend. You were recognised and supported. So it was... it's something that actually spurred me on, study. I was only an average student, but I did well in athletics and I just kept firing along with it.
What were you studying there? Just a normal curriculum?
Oh, yeah, just the average stuff, English, history, geography.
And you went straight from Westminster. Did you go to Roseworthy?
No, I went to the university. So actually it was at a time, 1967, the state government were wanting to increase the number of researchers in the Department of Agriculture substantially. So they had... a bit over 20 what we call cadetships. So these were payments where you... there were the days when you had to pay uni fees, and so they would pay your fees, so they would give you a bit of bloody support money, so you'll pay for your fuel and beer.
Yep.
And the requirement for that was that you had to work with them for 3 years, which didn't faze me at all.
No.
And that just meant I had a nice job lined up, which I worked in a plant disease area. Straight after that. So in uni were great years because we had the last 2 years out at Waite and we were a very strong group and great friends. And in fact, we still meet every year, a uni year, just a sort of reunion.
And beer was about 50 cents.
Whatever it was.
Which made it much more enjoyable.
Embarrassing how much we used to take along the shows. Now we drink light beer.
Happens to the best of us. Not me yet, but certainly Andrew, my co-host. Bit of a lightweight.
you would have thought.
Can we go to agronomy?
So yeah. you went to weight, and then you did diseases.
Yeah.
And then did you stay in the department after that for a while?
Or I did. I stayed in the department for 20 years, and the weight was a great spot because it again equivalent to the school, I suppose, high achievers. You had pretty leading research scientists working there, and you could get a sense of what these people were like. I mean, I was not one of them, but again, I said I was just an average student. I didn't do what you call postgraduate, so that's PhD, and just slogged away at that. And I got a bit distracted. I bought a block up in the Adelaide Hills, which is a bit silly, 20 acres, and then another 20, and I had a tractor and a seeder and built a barn out of bloody rock that I crowbarred out of the ground. I had
enormous, really?
Yeah, enormous energy.
How big was that? How big a barn did you build?
Big enough. I don't know. It was a shearing shed, and I used to go down the wool stores at Port Adelaide when they were dismantling wool stores. And
take some rocks. Take
timber back. This was for the flooring and all that sort of stuff. So I was doing all that and planting a lot of trees.
That's still standing today?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's still all there. Yeah, no, that's a fair while ago. So, I always had a sense that I wanted to work out with farmers. And so the work I used to do at the Wake was what you call applied. You could actually make a system where you could stay there and just work in glass houses and all this sort of stuff, but I wanted to be out and work with field work. And the fact that I was in the Department of Agriculture meant that was part of my job anyway, to be out and speaking with farmers, talking to bureaus. And they'd say, look, we've got this issue. I remember going down to Waruka and working with powdery mildew on barley down and back. And Millicent was the other place we used to go. It was a fair way to go.
So that's as a government employee?
Yeah, that's it. State government, Department of Agriculture.
Do those positions still exist today?
There is a strong group.
Only at a higher level, perhaps?
No, it's called SARDI, South Australian Research Division. So it's the same thing, essentially. It's the same.
Do they still have guys that go out in the field, SARDI?
Yeah, yeah, they do.
As much as what they used to?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay.
They don't have the advisory group. In fact, I only found out the other day that the last of this group was Michael Wurst at Jamestown. I think he's just retired. But there used to be an advisor at Kadena, was Trevor Dillon for a long time, and another people before him, and then Jamestown, Europe, to something. There was probably about 12 of them around the state.
Yeah.
And they would be able to
follow. So Newry's closed down now, is it?
I'm not sure where
this. That's where Tony Craddock was originally.
Yeah,
wasn't
then
it?
There
That's
was it. Also Locke, and can you believe it, and Lamoureux, and so on. So these people were all over the place, and they basically just ran the bureaus, I suppose. We'd go out and visit farms every now and then, but. I shifted up to here after 14 years at Waite and to Clare, because I had an offer of a position which was called crop protection. So it was broader than disease, so it was weed control in particular. And that took me a lot closer to farmers, and I figured still I could do a lot of the field experimental work based here. In fact, better, because I'm closer to it.
Yeah.
So I just had to need all the gear, the seeder, the harvest, all that small scale stuff that you get, which I did get eventually over 6 years. And that's... you're still hamstrung by the system.
Yeah.
There, whether you've got to go into state, you've got to write all this bloody scree, and if you're overseas, my goodness.
Yeah.
and to employ someone, you've got to go through all the public service protocol and all sort of stuff that. So I left. Walked away early 91 with basically nothing, and bought an old ute and worked out of home here. And... just started from
which
scratch.
Which is also in the hills.
Are you married? You had a few
kids? That's right. Pressure was on. We had a couple of little kids just in primary school. And so just had to try and make it work. And I picked the worst year you could ever pick. So that was to work with farmers. So that was 1991. So that was when wheat price was actually rock bottom, when the wool floor was pulled in February. And there was a few other things going on with people lost money in investments.
Yeah.
And so there was no mood for farmers to pay for agronomists. And this was one of the very early fee-for-service agronomists. There was one or two others at the time. But no mood at all. And so actually that year I worked with six farmers. Six. And I thought, bloody, this is not going to work. So I was pretty good at doing field trial work. And so I went to visit companies and said, you got any contract work to do? So this is companies who got new chemicals coming along. They want to test out over different crops and soils and stuff. And anyway, I went and visited five companies in Melbourne and got work from all of them.
Oh, wow.
And so that sort of kicked it off. And away I sort of went from there. And that that research business grew and grew, and I ended up employing a couple of blokes, and the shed just down here was full of gears, harvesters, tractors, seeders, trucks, you name it. And we were just flat out.
But you got pretty busy pretty quick by the sounds, right? How did you handle that?
Well, I don't know, you just keep going. Anyway, people say you've got to learn to say no, and I said, no, that's not the story. You just grab it and go. None of this saying no business.
Deal with the consequences.
That's just not on the
list. Time to get creative.
That's not in the list at all. So, I think I was probably up to 80 hours a week I was working. But because the farmer group grew after, what did I say, six the first year, probably 15 or 20, and then next thing it was 35, and then it got up to 72.
And still had the contract work.
Yeah.
From a chemical company.
Yeah. Did you have partners?
Slow nods of the head.
Oh, I had two blokes working with me on the contract work, but the farmer bit was me, pure and simple.
All right.
You can't just put on someone to work with farmers. Look, it's quite a personal business working with farmers. You get to know them and they get to know you. It's a bit like your local doctor or whoever, accountant.
Those were the days.
Shift around. But anyway, that's how I feel of it. And I've cut a long story short, I did have some agronomists working with me, but even though they'd come out of uni, they'd had to be here for probably 3 years at least before I would let them out with a farmer on their own, and that might be just for a routine thing, because there's that much that's got to go on in your head to be a pretty capable agronomist that you pick it up on the run. Yep. You can't get it out of a book or go to uni or anything like that. So there's a whole lot of feel in that game. So, that powered along, and then the precision ag thing started up, and I said, I'll get involved with that too. So what was this? With all their field trial work with that. Which year was it? GRDC, because I used to help run the advisor updates, the agronomist advisor updates in Adelaide, so I chaired that for a few years, and then the Hart field site. So that was that was as soon as I came to Clare. There was a couple of years where Kevin Jeske had a few trials out on his place, and then 1985, I guess it was very fortunate, there was another bloke based here at Clare as an agronomist, Barry Bull, and Barry had been around a bit. He'd been to Loxton. He was been actually in Jordan for a year or two, very keen on vetch. Anyway, he and I both cranked this up and turned this small medic trial into this bloody massive bloody Hart field site with the wheat varieties and fertilisers and goodness knows what. And we ran that at their place, and then eventually got the Hart group to buy land. And so they've got permanent sites and so on. And they've kept that same formula, and it's worked really well. So this year's the 40th year of the Hart field group, and it's just a credit to them that they've got this nice system of management where the chair is 2 years and they know who the next one is and stuff like that. They're not left floundering as to who's going to lead it the next time around. And they've got very good industry support, and they've just stuck with the same formula of being independent advice and not going into up roads that are a bit esoteric or whatever. It's just nuts and bolts of agronomy and farming. So that was one big thing.
Did that help you a little bit as well?
It always does.
Consolidate your work.
Yeah, and I can say the same about the contract work. I didn't describe that very much, but a lot of it was a chemical company would have a new herbicide. It would just come in a little bottle with a bloody AC121 or something, and that's all I knew about it. And you had to test this at three different rates, and with and with wetter and without a wetter, on wheat at three leaf, on the list four different types of weeds, and you go and find the site and do it. And then eventually you'd see it come onto the market, and you think, yeah, I know a bit about that. And this is what it'll do, and that's the effect, and this sort of thing. So I knew a lot. I mean, it wasn't breach of confidence or anything like that, but I just happened to know a lot about these chemicals when they got on the market. And the other thing was that when I'd set up the trial, and then they'd come around and have a look at it, and they might bring their national marketing research bloke, and they might even bring an international research bloke, and we're going to have dinner together and stuff like that. And you were just rubbing shoulders with these people. And in this game of agronomy, you'd always come across something that was a bit odd that you could quite handle. So I had their phone number. Not the international one. But I'd give them a buzz and say, what do you think? You know, they said, this is what I'd do. So, there was a really nice synergy.
It's got the chemicals. They've always had an alphabetical system for the different types of chemicals. There's that many chemicals now, we've gone to a numerical system.
Yeah, that's just really to make them international for the mode of action for herbicide resistance.
Right.
But, I mean, what floored me, I've been out of the game 10 years or more now, but it's often the same chemicals, it's just a different product name.
Yeah.
That's something you sort of got to get your head around. But so there's a lot of subtleties in chemicals. I mean, people say, you just go label rate and so on, but I've had enough to do with working, doing trials where they develop, use the information for labels to realise that there's times when the labels might not be right. There's certain dry years where you wouldn't do this, or under frost conditions you wouldn't do that, or you'd use a high rate sometimes, a lower rate sometimes, or you'd drop the rate.
You use a high rate when you haven't read the label correctly and it's double strength.
If someone is causing you grief and you don't want it to fail, you put the high rate in. Look, I always had the attitude of doing it the least cost option, so long as it was effective. And I had this sort of motto that farmers sort of should get the best return for the least cost and the least effort. And I've never met a farmer yet who disagrees with
it. Exactly.
So that's a big call. And I figured I should do the same with my business. So if I'm providing a service, I should have the least cost. And so I was always one of the lower cost people around. So with all this contract trial work we did for companies, we never lost a contract.
No.
They always come, because I would be only 2/3 the cost of anyone else.
Yeah.
But since I'm out of it, there's a lot of other players in the game.
Just wondering at this point, Overwatch, what's been the outcomes, if any, of Overwatch from last season? We can edit this out.
Yeah, not guilty. I mean, it's come in since I left, and I was out picking up furniture for the Lions the other day, and I went past this paddock looking yellow. I thought, what is that? And the farmer informed me what it was. But
oh, this year again?
Yeah, just up,
no, it's a. It's a. Symptom of that chemical. It's not meant to actually affect your yield, but it does affect your yield on some paddocks. I found that out for myself last year.
I mean, I went through this era with Glean and Ally, so you know, it takes you back. So when
Spinnaker.
Yeah, that too. I did all the development work on Spinnaker in South Australia. And but Glean in alkaline soils would just send crops bloody yellow and stuff like that. Mm. And Ally, when it was first released, actually stunted crops, and then they put MCPA with it and it didn't do it anymore. But
just one little thing in a way.
But you learn after a while what things are actually cause yield loss and some things don't. I was given this chemical by a company in contract to do this trial for controlling bed straw of wheat, and it just blitzed the bed straw of wheat, gave the highest yield compared with broadstrike and 2,4-D and other things. And it turned out it was actually a formulation of what became Affinity. But they had it mixed with a bloody a surfactant, which caused a lot of leaf bleach.
Yeah, and I tried that myself once.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It looks ugly from the road, and neighbours will come in, what the hell have you done to your crop? And this just scorched the leaves.
Yeah.
And I was looking at it, I was like, no farm would ever use this. And, of course, they didn't release it with that solvent or surfactant in it. It's a lot softer, but there was no yield loss from that loss of leaf. And no,
I just didn't look at it for a long time, man. It blitzed the weeds.
Same with, when you put UA in sometimes, it scorched leaves. And the old Diron used to do the same. I mean, these were heady days when people used to use Diron for trying to suppress sow sovereign wheat, 1.5 kilos. And the bloody sow sovereign would go yellow and the crop would go yellow and on sand it would half kill it. And then Ally came and just fixed it overnight. Mm. You would struggle to find a sow sovereign.
So what's the most exciting chemical you've seen released in your time? You obviously
Ally would be right up.
Ally.
Yeah, look, if you go back, a lot of people weren't born then, but in the 70s, the biggest constraints with wheat production was sow sovs.
Yes.
And there were three-cornered jacks and other stuff as well. And then underground on the root system was the Cirrhosis nematode, and was just bloody creating havoc, and so you had these miserable crops. If you got a 10-bag crop, you were just happy as all hell. And then, as I say, with bloody Diron, they were
Nemadai and Count.
And you were cultivating paddocks to try and You're cultivating paddocks to try and reduce the sow sobs. You're sowing late, and they grab the first bit of nitrogen to be available, and just overnight they just went. Glean did that, but Glean was tricky to use because of the residual problems. But our Ally just fixed it up.
Yeah, I'm not asking this question because of the amount of time you've been in the industry. I'm just curious, what was the first chemical ever made? Roundup?
If you want to go back in the true sense of chemical, like in chemistry, that people used to treat their wheat with copper sulfate to control bunt. And so, I mean, just it's curious that people talk about the natural and the synthetic, as if one's good and one's bad, but you get the complete overlap with all. But this bloody copper sulphate used to play Mary Hill with the wheat germination, I could tell you.
Yeah.
But that was, and they used to soak your bags, and you know, this was heavy going stuff. This was back 100 years ago.
Yeah, sure. No,
I've got a photograph here of a bloke, and it's taken out of a book, but he's standing on the back of a dray, the horse is pulling this dray, and he's working a hand pump, and he's pumping sulfuric acid onto the ground to try and control the weeds. So, you know, again, people are throwing their hands in the air about
it. That's organic farming at its best.
Yeah, wouldn't have been a glove or a face mask inside.
No, none of that. You know, so this, and look, I remember as a little kid, I suppose I was probably 10, but my farm, my dad bought a boom spray and he was spraying 2,4-D because we had turnip weed on our farm, and when you used to bloody harvest, you'd lock up the front of the header with the turnip weed and you'd drop the comb on the ground and drag it back and lift it up.
Okay.
Yep. You're forever harvesting like this, you know. Yep. And here's this chemical that went, phoom, overnight, that's totally gone.
Yeah.
And your harvesting efficiency and your crop yield just went like that. I mean, when you consider 2,4-D, what are we talking, 1950s probably when it first came out, and it's still here with us.
Mm.
It's not without some effort on Nufarm's part. They have to keep resubmitting stuff into APVMA to keep it going. But that's stood the test of time. Of course, glyphosate.
When did that come on the scene?
Well, it was the early 80s. So the glyphosate was involved a little bit with sow sod control. So this was in a pasture. So if you sprayed it in the early spring.
Drum,
exactly, yeah. So you got rid of the sow sods, but it was in a pasture year, and then so it wasn't a crop, but those were the days when people did have pasture. The early days of direct drilling were very much driven by ICI. So that was the spray seed mix, which sort of controlled weeds, but we had all these other issues that went with that, which was that this concept of allowing the weeds to grow and then spraying and waiting a couple of days to sow in gave some pretty ordinary crops. So because the weeds growing used up the nitrogen, they build up the root disease like Rhizoctonia, used up moisture in some situations, and so these were pretty poor crops. But if you did it after you had a great legume or something, life was a lot better.
Yeah,
I mean, then the list goes on a bit. So all the grain legumes in rotation became possible. The first of these was fusillade, so you could take the grasses out of these crops without hurting the crop.
I reckon I squashed one of the original Roundup drums this week.
You should have put it in a museum.
It was pretty old.
I mean, it's just.
It would have been a tin one though. Plastic wouldn't have been invented back then, would it?
I mean, it's just with dismay now that. There's the way that world is going with glyphosate. I mean, it's just bizarre that it's based on a jury decision, which is not scientific based at all. There's all this world reaction, and now the Germans have decided they're not going to use Roundup. It's not allowed to use in households or gardens for quite a few years now. But on farms, so I was there recently, and they said, no, end of 2024, that is it.
Wow.
And though the farmers will go back to ploughing. And their wheat production will drop, and you know for what reason?
All we've been hearing about over the last 2 years is trust the science, trust the science, trust the science. And now, when it comes to a chemical as universal as glyphosate, we're not going to trust the science anymore.
So I mean, a lot of people don't sort of trust. Trust is actually the key word, of course. I mean, Deanna Lush puts this in a perspective. She did a Churchill Fellowship on people's attitude to farming and chemicals, and it is. I mean, we just look at the cold science and the figures and see what it is, but there's a lot of the community that are at arm's length from agriculture that don't have that attitude at all. They just look at you up and down and say, would I trust this person or don't I trust this person?
Yeah.
And anyway, so that's the way it is, and it'd just be a sad day if that happened here in Australia, because we would just go, can you imagine that the sand erosion and the... We used to drive from Remark to Mildura and there'd be bloody sand all across the road. And
epoxytonazole is banned in UK.
Yeah, look, a lot of the banned label is pretty familiar with chemicals in the UK. So the companies have to reapply, I'm not sure exactly whether it's every 5 years or 10, but they to resubmit again with more information about toxicity and so on and so on. And they look at the market and they say it's not worth it. We won't reapply. So they just don't apply.
Ugh.
It's not like the government that said there's something wrong with this, we've got to pull it from the market. It's just so they would only have half the chemicals we have. They certainly have pulled imidacloprid because of the impact on native insects like bees, and that's making their rapeseed, or as they call it, our canola, really tricky to grow because they've got some insect problems in that.
Yeah. Right.
So where are we?
How are we travelling, Noel?
Yeah, good. I guess sort of started ignoring the list there because, Alan, geez, you've been around, you've seen it.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
We're only down here. We've only done three.
You've witnessed the adoption of single pass, basically, either tined or disc.
Mm.
Have you witnessed the improvement of the soils with this system rather than the...
Yep. Look, this business about soil health makes me wince a little bit because it's said commonly that and without any definition. So what do you mean? There's probably, I can think of at least 10 different aspects of soil health. Would it be acidity, pH, the porosity of the soil, the ability of water to get in and the air to move through to aerate the roots, to the biological activity, the turnover of nutrients, so on, so on. So, yep. So as soon as people say soil health, you want to pin them down and say, what do you mean?
Which bit?
Yeah, which bit, mate? So, look, the biggest thing that we saw with direct drilling, if we just go back before that with the cultivation set up, there's some soils around here that we call hard-setting red soils. They've been cultivated and cultivated. Like a farmer down at Kybunga told me when he was a lad, there was a paddock down there being cultivated 15 times. In one year. My grandfather grew up at
Sounds about right.
Grew up at Kybunga and I got his diary and as soon as they finished seeding, they started ploughing.
Yeah.
Fallowing. And so anyway, with these red soil patches, fine sandy clays, they would set hard and the water wouldn't go in and just run off. And you'd sow a crop and you get a rain after seeding it and the crop wouldn't come up through. So they'd go around and scratch around with the harrows and try and break the surface so the crop would come through.
Yeah.
And these were always miserable. And they were the areas where the ryegrass really thrived because the crop was growing so poorly. And then with direct drilling, we that just went overnight. We never see that again. So that's the water infiltration, water going in, and I've graphed the farmers that I've seen their what you call the water use efficiency, so how much yield they're getting per amount of seasonal rainfall year after year after year, and it just it started at a pretty poor level, and it basically doubled up to about where were we going? So we started in the 1990s, so probably about year 2000, a bit over, it sort of levelled off. And so I used to say to them, if you've got to grow, want to grow more wheat, you've got to buy more land. Yeah. We've got rid of all the limitations of our operation in terms of root disease and our nutrition is right.
It's only possible with herbicides. If we didn't have the herbicides, we would not be able to do this system of farming.
Yep. I remember Andy Barr said when he was on our planning committee for the one of the advisor updates, and he said, "But maybe we could learn from."
So he's more of a plant breeder, Andy.
Was at the weight then, and I guess. But anyway, he's on this organising committee for the agronomist updates we have every year with GRDC, and he said, "Oh, maybe because he's a bit out there with his ideas." And he said, "Maybe we should have an organic farmer come and speak at our conference because." We might learn something about controlling herbicide-resistant weeds. Righto. I said, I know a bloke in northern France. I've been to stay with him and I know him. He's been here. And anyway, we got Pierre out and it was a bit curious. But Pierre's situation. So he will sow the crop and then he will drive through the crop when it's sort of early tillering with this sort of cultivating bar in front of the tractor, cultivating between the rows. Or he'd have a bean crop and then he'd drag finger-tine harrows through it on a drying day to try and control the weeds. So well, they do half a job. Do half a job, and if you're not, So that was how that's where they are still. Although in his case, in northern France, they were in a pretty nice farming area, and he could grow loosened hay for a couple of years and then put a wheat crop in.
How many hectares are they doing in this method?
Bugger all. You can't have scale.
Unless you've got a big family.
So there's nothing there, and they, you know, whether you're zapping with a microscope wave, it's not going to work. And it's hard to visualise, imagine what. Whether there'd be a sensible alternative, I can't think of one. If you didn't have the chemicals we've got now.
No. So farming is where it is today, and who are the real heroes? Who's made the biggest changes? Would it be the agronomists like yourself or maybe the plant breeders like Andy Barr? Because, I mean, plant breeding has come along in leaps and bounds, hasn't it?
It was the... and then you got the chemical companies who and I've mentioned chemicals earlier, but certainly the plant breeding in terms of CCN control was the big advance. And then it became incremental after that in terms of, well, in Andy's case, was with oats, was reducing the height and increasing the yield, and then high quality. And then with wheat, they were always, you know, some the old story is sort of keep peddling to stay the same. So this was to do with rust resistance. So one of the things I got very involved with when I was a plant pathologist was stem rust in wheat. So we had 2 years, 73, 74.
I remember that. That's how old I am.
Yeah. I was born then.
And they just went smash, smash. And the bloody crops, like they said, no, you won't get rust 2 years in a row. And
they were massive. Well, I've convoked Dad telling me how good these crops
were. Oh, they were. There was halberd wheat and they just lost it, you know. I've got a little buddy bottle here on the seal, the one over there. It's got rusted wheat just to remind me that how bloody miserable wheat seed looks like when it gets rusted. You wouldn't even feed it to your chooks.
Oh, no, it's not even chook food.
You wouldn't feed it to you. So that just reminds you how bad that can be. So the wheat breeders...
Wow, how old's that?
That's 1976. When I did a trial in it,
you would have seen it, I suppose, Andrew. No, the lid's loose, mate. The lid's loose, so don't spill it.
You can't get that anymore because we just don't get rust. I mean, a few years ago, GRDC wanted to get some more information on fungicides on stem rust and they couldn't get a decent site because the way the farmers were spraying for whatever, stripe rust or whatever, it was just keeping the lid on it. But those days, all we had was one fungicide, Baylaton, and it was pretty expensive and it was real touch and go whether you'd actually use it. And we were trying to work out how to use fungicides. It was all very iffy. And plant breeder was the way to go because Northern New South Wales, they've been on top of that game for 100 years nearly from the Sydney University plant breeding, and we just sort of got behind a bit. So that's another instance of plant breeding. So there's no doubt that the varietal resistance is a much better way to farm than farmers going spraying for disease.
But we still need the agronomist, so we know which ones to spray.
I've basically avoided your question.
No, we're giving the points to Andy, but we still need agronomic advice.
That's plant breeding side. Of course, the chemical company side, that's way outside the scope of what anyone can do in Australia. These are massive organisations, be it Bayer or DuPont or whoever, and they test thousands of chemicals before they get one that actually hits the market. The agronomists, the cynical view is they take the information from one farmer to the other. There's a sense of that, and the farmers that actually you see would expect you to do that, but at the same time respecting their privacy if need be. But look, I've encouraged all my life that farmers cooperate and share information. And I've did that mainly through doing trips away. So each year I reckon I've done 17 altogether. So they love going to Western Australia. So we'd fly, we'd get on a bus for a week, go around, visit farms, trials, agronomists, whatever, and they would chat to each other on the bus. And they would, a bit of that. So they
do.
They would tell me that they would learn as much from each other on the bus.
It's interesting you say that. We've had a chat with John Gladigow about
his Nuffield.
That, and also he's got this Facebook page, which I think at that stage had 25,000 followers. Well, I think it's up to 40. Mm. And the majority of them are farmers, and they are sharing information all the time because that's what farmers do.
And I don't know too much of the rest of the world, but in other professions, but I would think this is pretty unique in farming. I can't imagine real estate agents or bankers or whoever it might be.
I think the banks probably talk to each other quite a bit.
Okay. But
so do the fuel companies at the moment.
I mean, you can have a culture of not sharing. In the USA, I've been to the USA a couple of times and taken groups of farmers over there, and you get this sense of a little bit of privacy there, but I've certainly nurtured and encouraged the farmers to share.
It's not the level of business to hold your cards to your chest.
You could have something yourself that looks that's you've developed, and
it's never going to put you that far in front of everybody else.
Absolutely,
so you
right.
might as well have everybody on the same plane.
Exactly. It won't. Look, it doesn't make or break a competition in farming, and competition's a bit of a funny thing in farming because it's really comes to the fore. But it's people get a lot more value out of sharing stuff than they do keeping themselves. Absolutely.
Geez, I wish I bought my glasses.
So sporting achievements and other hobbies.
Sports, you got time for sports in amongst all of that?
I think you might have.
Oh, well, there's a few other things going on right now. Yeah, look, I ran at school and I was sort of okay, like middle distance.
Middle distance running.
800 and 1500 metres, and I was probably third in the state or something like that, third or fourth. But never went on with it because that's sort of pretty intense training. And then I just ran longer distance and ran around, fiddling around, and came up to Clare.
What sort of longer distance?
Oh, well, I did a marathon from Gawler to Adelaide.
42 kilometres. Oh!
Ultra marathons?
No, none of that. No, steady on. I came up here in 85 and I started a running event, sort of actually a fundraiser for the primary school for many years, and a 10K run. A few people had come, and nearly as many organisers had come. And long and short of that is that since then there's the South Australian Roadrunners Club have come up, and they run a half marathon here every year, so I help that, and they do it on the Riesling Trail, which I'm heavily involved with. So then about a bit over 20 years ago, I suppose, I was in my early 50s, and I just noticed this about a Masters Athletics in Adelaide, and Masters game. I wonder what that is. So I got the old spikes here from school, and I went down there on the running track, and these were, this was a national thing, and it's okay. Like, I just come third in the 15 or 800.
In 30-year-old spikes.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, no, look, the clothing doesn't... I'll give you a few tips about running in a tick, but the clothing and nutrition and everything is not it. It's training one, two, and three. But I so I did that for a bit, and then they had a couple of those one that year, and a couple of years later, I think, back in Adelaide, and then they had a bloke in Adelaide. There's a Masters Athletics Club, and he said, "Oh, do you want to come down?" I don't know about this, but it's too good for me. So I went down there and didn't tell anyone. I was just standing there watching, and you know, these people running, bloody hell. They're going quick around the track. And anyway, bit by bit, I went in that. And then Australian Championships came up, so I went in that, and I was sort of still getting that second or third. And then, but steeplechase, I was good. I win the steeplechase, you see.
Wow.
And so I...
you don't want to fall over one of those jumps, because they'll, not, they'll bring the gun out and just shoot you.
No, they don't. So I've... So I started doing those, I don't know, 15 years ago. So I've never been beaten in Australia, steeplechase. So I've got the Australian record for steeplechase.
All right, you're on.
Yeah. So you're then, when I finished seeing farmers, I thought, I'll give this a bit of crack, so a bit more training. Because when you're with farmers, you're getting back late at night and sort of stuff, and just no time for training. So you train. So at the moment I train six times a week.
And what does that involve?
Oh, well, that's some. The moment it's marathon training, because we're going to London Marathon later this year.
Oh, wow.
But just to finish on this other stuff, so I went to America in about 10 years ago to Sacramento to a world championship. Well, actually, a few years before, I turned up one in Italy, and I said, just come and have a look, see what it's like, and went in a heat for the 800 metres and came about 16th, and top 12 go through, so I said, all right, that's okay, know how it works. So I went to US, but I was a bit fitter then, and I got in the final of the 800 out of about 50 runners and came about six, I think, and same with the 15. And then the steeplechase, I had this Russian bloke roll alongside me. There's a photo up there, this one. See underneath that Qantas thing? Yep. Yeah, that bloke alongside. And pushed me along, and I came second.
Wow.
In the world. So I thought, stuff, what's going on?
Far out. I had no idea.
And then there was in Perth... about 4 or 5 years ago, so I actually won it in the end. I bloody got there.
Well done. Well done.
Got there. So, but
that is outstanding.
But it's a leveller. This is bloody, this thing, you'll turn up another time and it won't work. But depends who else turns up. But that trophy sitting up in the corner up the top there, that glass thing, yeah, that's for the most outstanding middle distance runner in Australia. So that was 2 years ago. So I won the world 800 and the 1500 in Poland.
Not too shabby.
against the best in the world. So a Dutch bloke,
What age group are we looking at?
Men 70 to 75. So all this is in 5-year age brackets.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's actually great things to go to, because I've probably been to 8 international competitions. Wow. So they take over a fortnight, and you're there and you visit the city and you look around.
So for 800 metres, how quick can you cover 800 metres?
Well, that one in Poland was 2:31. And
I've got no idea after, I haven't ran in a while.
It'll take me 10 minutes to walk a kilometre.
I'll be leaving my smartwatch off when I do too.
Yeah, it's a bit silly. You take an hour to warm up and then it's all over in 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
Whereas a marathon, you don't have to warm up much at all. You just get going. So because all these international events have been cancelled. The one in Canada I was going to a couple of years ago. And so I thought, I'll get back into a bit of longer distance, see what happens. So, because I did it this school in Adelaide, I obviously mucked it up. I went too fast too early and got about 30-odd Ks and bloody fatigued. Well, I finished it, but it wasn't pleasurable. But I, no running is actually. It's all hard work. So then I went in an Adelaide marathon last year, and same deal. I just got caught up in this, talking to these blokes and run along too fast and got there in the end. But so I've determined to bloody do one properly so I can keep running all the way through without stopping.
Yeah.
So I went to the UK in April and went in one. Boston, of all places, a little village. Oh, okay. It's the original Boston, not the Boston
USA. No, the Boston
and, and that didn't work, and so it was too slow, and so I come back and rethought what I was training, and I realised I had to do a lot more with leg strength, some more hills and stuff. So anyway, I went to Pitchy Ritchie a few weeks ago and just sailed through there. So,
oh, you ran up through the hills?
Yeah, did.
How many? What, so just for those that... And up to speed, marathon, how many Ks is that?
That's 42.
42 Ks.
Yeah, so it's taken me a bit
and
over
you'd
4 hours.
You expect to do that in about how many hours?
Four.
Four.
Yep. Yeah, I'm trying to get under four. So my last fling at this will be in London in October. And that way you get to see the city from the street rather than the footpath. And I'll see how we go. But that's no hill. You start up at Greenwich Village, downhill a bit, and then you follow the Thames all around and loop and here, there and everywhere.
So. Yeah, but when you're running, unfortunately, whatever goes down also goes up.
It's a mental thing where you've got to work out what your training should be, and you look and listen to other people and so on, but you've basically got to work it out for yourself, how hard you go, when you have rest breaks, what sort of strength training you do and all sorts of stuff, and you've got to learn pretty quick. And then when you're in the race yourself, you've got to learn how to pace yourself and not go too fast, and whether you have bloody food along the way or whatever. And it's quite a thinking thing. It might sound like all brawn, but you can bugger it up.
You can
bugger it. Oh, well, yeah, if you're training in like this 800 metres and 15, that's gritty stuff. Like your training is really intense. Like there's a lot of repetition, 200s and stuff like that. And you just, you got to be half mad or. You've got to be motivated.
Well, let us know if you need a pit crew at any point in time in the future. I'm sure you come along and hand out some bottles of water.
Does your wife, is it Sue?
Yeah, Sue.
Does she share a passion for running?
No, she doesn't. No, she looks at it somewhat curiously at what I do.
Very sensible.
But she knows. About children.
No, well, my son was a sprinter at school, but that's where it ended, and my daughter, no. No, I probably got it from my mother. She was fit and lean, but I don't know. So it's a combination, I guess, of your physical ability and your mental determination and slightly.
You got any other hobbies?
Well, no, I just, when I finished seeing farmers, that was an interesting story. So working with farmers 20 years, you get to know them really well, visit farms, end up going to weddings of the kids, whatever. And you almost become one of the family, just about. And so it became quite an awkward thing to wind it back because I wanted to find a bit more space in my life and the travelling. And you get a sense when you sort of had enough, but I don't want to stay on too long. I don't want to be like John Howard and stay on too long.
Yep.
I want to be like who was the New Zealand Prime Minister, Keyes, who pulled the plug and said, oh, he pulled out at the top. Anyway. If you stay on too long, you get cranky. The people working with you don't like it and so on. So that's possible. I've seen it in other people. So I wanted to pull out and you go to farmers and say, look, I'm not coming next year. And they said, well, yes, you are. And go and get rid of someone else, not me. So it was all pretty awkward and time-consuming. So at the start of, 2010, I just went around. I was going around doing the autumn visits. I said, this is my last year. Here's 9 months' notice. They said, what? Yeah. So I said, no, that's it. So I had a couple of lads working with me, and they divvied it up, but they did it their own way with their own business. And then I went around harvest time, had a good chat to them. There you go. Thanks for everything.
Yep.
Anyway, come February, I was invited out to Bungaree, George and Sally Hawkers, one Friday night for dinner. So that's nice. Got a nice bottle of wine. There we go. They're all out there. Big surprise show.
Brilliant.
Yeah, no.
Brilliant.
And yet when I left the department bag, there wasn't much at all or anything like that.
But, the budgets so were a bit thin.
It really – attitude. It just reinforces the fact that farmers are just great to work with.
Yeah.
That's great to work with.
Yeah. Good,
honest lot. And it's the highlight of my career.
Community.
Trevor Dillon said that to me once. He said when he left the department of working with farmers, he said working with farmers one-to-one was – the highlight of his career, in spite of everything else that he did. So There you go. But then I was...
It would have been tough to walk away from, especially when you rock up to an event like that and you go...
You know when your time is there, because I was still... And by then I was heavily involved with GRDC.
I was on the state panel
for 7 years, and then I got involved in a lot of project management work. They'd ring me from Canberra. You wouldn't hear for 6 months because I never applied for anything. I just sort of get this call out of the blue. By the way, can you go interstate and coordinate all this work and go and visit this and this, or write up scope that? So I did that for probably about 8 years. And then that sort of finished. And then I got involved with SAGET. And I reckon SAGET was one of the highlights of my career, because just a beaut group. This is the state equivalent of GRDC, South Australian Grains Industry Trust. So they have five farmers who... make the decision on what projects are going to be funded and other sort of decisions about how SAGET's run. So, and it's run by an executive, part-time executive, Malcolm Buckby, and I was the science advisor. So I used to go, I made a point of going to visit just about all the projects. So we go and look at the trials and see how they're getting on and report back. So that way you knew what was going on. So, the farmers were great to work with. Andy Bars is one of the trustees here. So they're just... And we were able to do things that GRDC couldn't do. We could move quickly. We could make quick decisions, get things started, and shift direction if it wasn't working properly. And we had their trust. We had their trust.
Yeah. Working with the government, the cogs never spin quickly. We were talking about this on the way up.
A bit of a topical thing at the moment, this issue with foot and mouth disease in Indonesia. How concerned are you about that?
Oh, you'd have to be extremely concerned.
And the government are not moving.
Well, it's interesting, on sort of night where they actually do have this footpath now that people do walk through.
Oh, they do? Okay.
Curiously, it was citric acid, but I guess that does the job, because previous to that, someone said that it had to be 15 minutes. Now, you'd like to have a scientist rather than a politician telling you exactly what the setup is. But so...
Is that at every airport now?
I don't know. They're onto it. I mean, in fact, there was a lady there. She said, look, if I had to give away all my footwear, I would. But she'd be in the minority. But it rests
absolutely.
I mean, we will always sort of have this, excuse me, this threat of things coming. I mean, you go way back when we talk about chemicals, the threat of losing chemicals is a big threat.
Yeah.
Huge threat. And threats of disease incursion and the varroa mites, another one. And you just think maybe it's just a bloody matter of time, but I guess
so mobile these days. You only had to watch what happened with COVID.
Yep.
And it just, yeah, it is a concern.
Yep.
And it would be very bad for the agriculture industry. Just absolutely, the livestock would be.
But fortunately, things are going along beautifully at the moment. We don't want to get too down on that.
This is a situation where you really put your faith in the organisations, but like putting your faith in the pilot of an aeroplane. There's no strings we can pull. There's nothing we can do, and we just trust that they got it sorted out as best they can.
Yep.
A lot riding on it, that's for sure. What's the funniest thing you've ever seen happen on a farm? Could have been your own farm back on the West Coast. Or it could have been
something. I know you like sort of think of tractors upside down in the creek and all this sort of thing.
No, I do, but I'm fascinated about what you might have.
I've got a different perspective on things that young agronomists wouldn't be aware of, that this is the women in the business give you a perspective, and it's not necessarily the funniest, like it just you'd like sit and laugh, but it makes you stand up a bit. They have a different perspective than the blokes, as you probably realise.
Oh, every now and then I've sort of had that opinion myself.
Anyway, this I'll give you a couple of examples. This lad down near Tali Way, and he was